my experience has been that if you can show impact, if you can show like a pricing matrix table that says, hey, you should not be able to configure the, you know, single sign-on for a non-enterprise organization, and you can, and it works for like a pro level organization or something like that, and there's a little X in the box for pro, and there's a little, you know, check mark in the box for for business, then
the
they're
true crux
like,
of having
right.
documentation for your product is, I mean, that's a bug bounty hunter reading
right?
it.
Like, that's the, you know, and
if
yeah,
you never make documentation, then they can't call you out on it.
Hey everyone, this is TechnoGeek here. Just wanted to give a quick shout out to our latest sponsor, Project Discovery. Now, Project Discovery makes a lot of tools that you probably know of or have even used. One of them is Nuclei, and the latest release of Nuclei is version 3.2. Now, 3.2 comes with a lot of really awesome new features. Two that I really wanted to highlight here for you are the authenticated scanning and the advanced fuzzing support. Now, for authenticated scanning, it used to be that you would have to do all your Nuclei scanning against unauthenticated endpoints, or you'd have to add your cookies manually, all that kind of messy. No more. It's all automatic. You can use existing login templates to automatically log in to your application, and then you can run all your existing Nuclei templates against an authenticated part of the application now to really increase your coverage. The other that I mentioned is advanced fuzzing support. Now, Nuclei had added way back in version 2.8 the ability to fuzz different things, but now they've expanded this comprehensively across the board. So not only can you fuzz in the normal spots, but you can fuzz within headers. You can fuzz within cookies. You can fuzz within specific parts of the body, whether that's in JSON or XML or form data, and so many more things. So if you want to learn more about what came in Nuclei 3.2, go ahead and check out the release blog post over at nux.gg/podcast. That's nux.gg/podcast. Thanks.
You hear that?
Nothing like that, the sweet smell of allergies.
That is that is the sweet sound of a clear nasal passage.
And yeah, mine
sickness is gone.
I'm almost there. I'm like 90% of the way there.
All right. Well, hang in there, man. Hang in there. I'm feeling 110% back in the game after last week. Having a nice restful week off, so thanks for taking over the pod last week, man.
Yeah, of course, absolutely.
We got some stuff we're going to cover today, as usual. You've been doing some hacking lately. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Sure, yeah. I talked about it a little bit at the beginning of last episode, but yeah, I've been... I took a little vacation, and I was... I got that little itch again. And I just started digging in on some target that I had been interested in for a while. And I just found a bunch of really interesting, you know, sort of almost bugs and stuff. And then I hit a bit of a stopping point. So I sent a bunch of it over to you. And then in like 5 minutes, you started escalating stuff.
Classic collaboration.
We started writing stuff up. We submitted it. Then we checked the scope page. And it was explicitly out of scope, so we self-closed it. So yeah, it's just one of those things. But it was a good experience.
Have you followed up with that target at all after that day, or did we get a gut punch there with the out of scope?
Well, I think I had to return back to normal a little bit as well. I think I lost a little bit of the momentum. So. Haven't returned back to the target yet, but
do you think
maybe
you will?
I will. I might. I think that there's some other things for me to look at.
That website was sketchy as heck, dude.
There's a lot of weird things going on.
There was a lot of weird stuff. I think it happens, you know, sometimes. And I think it's good to put it on air and on the pod as well that, you know, this sort of thing happens to more experienced bug hunters as well, where you're just like, you know, you kind of get in your flow or you're excited to look at a target or whatever. And you start poking at it, what did you say? Pokety poke at it. poke at it till you can't poke at it anymore. And then, you realize something's out of scope. And, you know, it's just that the L's we take along the way in bug bounty, right?
It happens. It happens. It's all part of the process, you know?
It is indeed. It is indeed. So speaking of L's, I did want to talk a little bit about the Ambassador World Cup, because every other country besides the U.S. is going to be taking an L. Hopefully that's true.
I wasn't sure where you were going with that. I was like, wait a sec.
The first round of the Ambassador World Cup has been completed, and the results are not, and when I say the Ambassador World Cup, of course, I'm speaking about the HackerOne Ambassador World Cup hacking competition, where ambassadors from all of the different countries around the world and their teams are competing in a hacking competition for what last year was an in-person live hacking event and a bunch of prizes and that sort of thing. So pretty fun little thing. However, something was really odd with it this year, which kind of threw me off a little bit as a full-time hunter. Okay, so we've got over 700 hackers participating in this, right?
It's a pretty big event.
It's massive. So just for scale size, that's, you know, 15 times the normal live hacking event, right? 50 people, you know, roughly. So it puts it at a pretty decent ratio there. There's no dupe window. That seems a little off to me, man. Because, like, for me as a full-time hunter who's doing this for my livelihood, right? Why am I going to expose myself to what is the equivalent of probably 100 times or more the dupe risk? And man, I have seen some absolutely gutting dupes come through from this live hacking event. Like people working really hard, getting what should be 25K plus crits, getting duped out. And they submitted them within, you know, the first couple days of the competition.
Yeah. So I think
I don't know. It seems a little off to me.
Yeah. So we have participated in the Ambassador World Cup before. Mm-hmm. Yeah. From the program side, I have. I don't remember how it works, and they might have changed it this year. But it could be a points thing. So one thing to remember is that teams are given points based on the severity of bugs found. Mm-hmm. I don't recall how duping affects that and whether or not dupes count. Like, if you have a dupe of a crit, does that count as points even though it's not a bounty? No.
It does not. Okay. So it's like, it's kind of like a double whammy, because obviously, you know, if dupes counted, you would be getting some gamification of that whole thing. But, you know, it's no bounty, no points, right? And I could understand if they wanted to say, like, okay, you know, we'll give you you know, no points, because whoever gets the first submission in gets the points, but no bounty, across these 700 hackers, so many of them have spent all this time hacking on these targets. I can't even fathom the amount of, like, hacker hours wasted because of dupes on this, right? Whereas at least with the live, and then here's the other piece of this, right? Like, the bounties aren't that inflated for the Ambassador World Cup, right? So if they were mega inflated, it's like, okay, well, I'm exposing myself to a little extra risk for a little extra reward, right? But the only reward in this situation is you get to move on to the next round of the Ambassador World Cup, right?
Yeah.
And so I think for me as a full-time hunter, it's hard for me to justify just from a financial perspective whether, like, should I be investing time in this or not, because at the end of the day my dupe risk is so much higher and my reward is nominally, you know, more. So yeah. I don't know, maybe I'm off base with that. That being said, I did put, you know, I want to say like 15 hours or so, like 2 days into the competition, just to kind of support my team. I got a couple triaged bugs, so nice. You know, it is what it is. You know, it'll pan out one way or the other. But I next, and also let me just caveat this explanation with, like, I get that it's hard for HackerOne to deal with dupes and at this scale. You know, when we're dealing with 700 hackers, how do you even, in like 1,400 submissions, how do you even dedupe across 1,400 submissions? Very challenging across three targets even. But I still think that it strongly de-incentivizes the hacker that takes their time and you know, time investment in these sort of things seriously.
Yeah, yeah, it's definitely tricky, because I don't think the programs are asked to operate, you know, really differently than, you know, they're basically still the public programs that are participating, right? So it's not like a full-on live hacking event or anything like that. It's like halfway between. So
yeah, I did appreciate that the bounties for the for one of the targets, they increased the mediums and the lows at least, which is like, okay, nice. You know, that's something. And yeah. I think increasing mediums is an underrated play by programs, because that really does help put some, you know, cash back in the hacker's pocket along the way, especially if you're like a very like a chain heavy and like a sort of a progressive hacker like I am. Like, I'll get in there and I'll find a couple of mediums. You know, I'm looking at these sort of medium and low severity bugs as well as going for these bigger ones instead of trying to put them all together. So, but sometimes along the way, you're just going to run into some mediums. So it definitely helps to get those paid out well.
Yeah, for sure. And I will say, like, the one advantage that there is to sort of, you know, making it to that next round, other than, you know, just the fact of making it there, is that theoretically that you know, rate or whatever goes down as you know, filter down to fewer and fewer teams. So in theory, it does get easier in a sense, or hard, you know, harder, but easier, like less dupes, but more skilled teams.
Yeah. Yeah. It's more of a hustle, I think, you know, in this first round than it will be in the later rounds. And that's what some of the guys in the chat were saying, but, maybe it's the price you pay. And for me, you know, as somebody who, for me and you, Joel, you know, people that are sort of accustomed to the live hacking event circuit or whatever, it may seem as like, okay, well, why aren't we being actually incentivized here? but for, you know, the people that haven't had the opportunity to participate in a live hacking event and that's their like, you know, bucket list item or whatever, then, you know, having the opportunity to participate in a live hacking event is like the ultimate motivation. So
yeah,
I can
see. Yeah. Have you ever seen an F1 race?
Have what?
Have you ever seen an F1 race?
Have I ever seen? Oh, an F1 race. No, F1 I race. Haven't seen an F1 race.
Okay. Well, have you ever seen like a clip of an F1 race starting?
No.
Okay. Well, maybe this analogy will fly over you, but I feel like this is this is very much so like the first turn in the race where it's always turn one where just like shit hits the fan.
Oh,
and
man.
All the cars just like everybody's like starting and trying to like get ahead. Yeah, yeah. Everybody's really tight. They're trying to like get whatever lead they can. They're all like, you know, inches from each other, and like Dez's disaster strikes, and then whoever just makes it out of that is immediately like, ahead of the pack.
Right?
So that's kind of like what's going on here with round one of the World Cup. Is
I see it.
You know, it's turn one, so everybody's neck and neck, and whoever makes it through the bloodbath at the beginning will you know, inevitably lead the pack.
We'll see. I don't know where I think last night US was in fourth place or something like that. So
I think we're third now, actually.
Are we at third? Nice.
I believe so.
Sweet,
so
sweet. Yeah. So hey, you know, there's a chance. There's a chance.
Yeah.
Dude, I don't know why. Like, I don't know if it was just like the intonation or something, but it sounded like you were saying, like, have you ever seen an F1 race? Like, and I was like, is this some sort of like knock knock joke or something like that? Like, I don't know how I'm, who's there? You know, like, I don't
Elephant
know how I'm
who?
Supposed, exactly. Like, how am I supposed to respond to this? all right. Well, moving along from that, Did you get a chance to peek at this NoKline Zoom ATO?
Yeah, man. Dude. Really interesting bug. There was some stuff in there that I was like, I don't even know. Like the Google OAuth thing.
Yeah.
Is that like a 0-day? I don't even...
No. You know, I think it depends on the implementation. You know, Google's got a bunch of little nuances to their OAuth flow, but... I thought this one was really a really cool example of like a really solid client-side exploit chain and sort of using all these different pieces along the way. You've got a little bit of CSP, you got a little bit of cookies, you got, you know, cookie tossing, you've got the post-based XSS, you've got the cookie XSS, and then chaining it all the way through to create something of massive impact. And I was actually thinking about Ejol whenever I was reading this, because I was like, you know, I know that your focus has often been a lot on mobile and APIs and that sort of thing. When you're looking at this stuff, a lot of times you're looking more at, you know, the back end stuff, because that's the stuff you've got more exposure to when it comes to, you know, hacking APIs through the mobile front. And this is, I think, is just a really cool example of like how all of this stuff can be applied in front end, in the browser, in a full chain. So for any of you guys that haven't read it, it's super good. We'll link it in the description. I guess the TLDR of this is that there was a cookie-based XSS in Zoom that affected, I love this, the CSP feature for Zoom. So apparently you could set a cookie that would reflect a nonce into the CSP. And So this was a really interesting takeaway that is also something that I've been looking at recently. The way that they reflected their content into the header, the CSP, the nonce attribute for the script. Thank you, Joel. So Joel's over there like, you got it, Justin. was this cookie parsing thing. Have you seen this like double quoted cookie parser oddity?
Yeah, so I guess I never really thought about it, but I definitely have seen this where cookies, right? If you think about it, this kind of exists in a couple different areas. I think a great example of it is with HTML elements, actually, where you can define an HTML attribute within an element without quotes, with quotes, with slashes. You know, there's a ton of different separators, right? So you could just be like input equals value, and then you can put a space and it'll just assign value to input, or you can surround it with quotes. Maybe there's special characters or delimiter,
single quotes, double quotes,
right? Exactly. So it's a very similar kind of thing here where I assume that the reasoning is maybe there's special characters, maybe there's spaces. I think technically you're supposed to URL encode cookies, cookie values entirely. But this is probably trying to account for maybe some weird special edge case, or just to give the option for you to send a non-URL encoded cookie, which I don't really know how that would ever happen. So you can basically wrap your cookie values in quotes or double quotes, and that seems to allow you to basically bypass it by like wrapping a double quote in a single quote, right?
Exactly. So there's a lot of oddities to the way that cookies are parsed, and I feel like it's not something that's super looked into. And we talked about this actually at the beginning of the year in the top 10 web hacking techniques from 2023 post, because there was some research done, and I forget who it was by, but I've actually referenced it on a couple podcasts since then. So I think it was probably some of the more impactful research that was done in 2023 for sure. About cookie parsing, and like, for example, you can put like cookies that don't have any values or cookies that don't have like some specific parts of it, right? And it will sometimes the backend server will get confused and like smush cookie values together, and you'll be able to like cancel out headers or other cookies, you know, by setting a specific cookie. So there's all sorts of oddities there. And the one that they're using in this scenario is that if you put in, you know, let's just say you set the cookie value for this nonce to ABC double quote, you know, ABC, right? It's going to properly figure that out and remove the double quote and just put it into the nonce, you know, it just ABC, and then cut off everything after that. But if you open the cookie value with a double quote, so you're doing like equals double quote and then a ABC backslash double quote ABC, and then close it with a double quote, then it's sort of like a string encapsulated value for that cookie, and then that value gets reflected unescaped into the script nonce attribute in HTML. And I think that this was a very apt time for me to be reading this write up, because there was a vulnerability that I discovered recently that I was not able to exploit. And that a lot of, let's just, let me see.
Oh, I know what you're talking about.
I need to be more vague about this, because, because it's still.
A lot of hackers were unable to, yes.
A lot of hackers were unable to exploit this vulnerability. And there was a particular hacker, a hacker that you will hear, you guys will hear this write-up story at some point. But a particular hacker was able to come in and exploit this vulnerability because of very similar logic to this, with a double quote being placed into a cookie value and being able to cut off like the cookies that come after this up until another double quote or some other weird parsing, cookie parsing nonsense. So I think that this is a really strong takeaway, is like, if you get caught in a situation where your cookie, like maybe you need to do cookie tossing and you're sending two cookies to the server, or like there's a cookie that isn't being reflected properly, or you know, you need to get rid of a cookie somehow, playing around with this cookie parsing logic of where does this cookie end, where does it start, with the double quotes, with the single quotes, with backslashes, with different uses of semicolons, which is the delimiter for cookie attributes and that sort of thing. All of those are really high rate of success techniques, I think, more than I thought so before reading this write-up.
Yeah. So a couple of thoughts that I have on this. One, it's probably a good opportunity for some sort of automation or tooling around testing cookie values for a couple different, you know, escapes and conditions and just alerting and saying, hey, there's, you know, this cookie on this endpoint supports being encapsulated with quotes or something. That's one thing. Another thing that I was thinking about is I would almost never test this, and it's such an interesting gadget to have found because I'm really guilty of taking all the cookies in my request, and the first thing I do is I delete every single one of them except for the ones that I need, because cookies, like a lot of time the cookie string is just really long and like you know, busy, and I want to just be able to look around it, and so I'll say, okay, which one of these is the auth cookie? I'll remove everything else except for that one, and then I'll minify my request down to just that, and I don't even look at the cookie values, and so I probably would have never found this.
Yeah,
I can understand. You know, it's good to know sort of like what's required in the requests and to be able to identify, you know, maybe unauthenticated requests or what part of the request is providing authentication. But yeah, I'm super guilty of that, so. I think testing for this and testing those types of values, like inherently, I don't even know if, like, let's say, you know, like the reflection in the CSP issue, that by itself is not like really an issue. Like, yeah, you can leverage it, like as it was demonstrated in the blog, but by itself is like, you know, what are you going to do with that? You have to have something else that can set that cookie and then, you know, actually like leverage it to trigger the XSS. So it's just one of those things that is a super useful gadget, but testing it by itself is a very interesting thing. Like, I don't, unless I was looking for something explicit, right? Like it was like, okay, let me try and find a gadget that I can use later. Or I would probably do it in reverse, honestly. If I found something, some XSS and I wanted to escalate it, being able to, you know, then find a cookie that I can reflect, you know.
Well, I agree. I think in this scenario, like a lot of times cookie-based XSS is sort of like an open redirect. Like you don't really look for it until you need it, you know? And I think maybe that's a little underrated, because I think there's probably more stuff there than we often go after, because we're not often really fuzzing stuff in the cookies as like a matter of habit, or at least I'm not. Maybe
I'm not either.
And that
was
one
of the big takeaways I had as well when we were hacking together, was like, I started sending you stuff and you were like, I wonder if, you know, how this works. And then you were like, oh, here, I got it. And you had fuzzed the parameter names, with like a static value, and you'd found it like a hidden parameter, that allowed us to do something. And, you know, I was like, oh, I need to start doing that.
Well, the interesting thing about that was you found this like crazy endpoint that's like clearly like, what was it, like slash render HTML or something
slash
like PDF that?
PDF proxy.
Exactly. It's like okay, we got to figure out how this works. So yeah, definitely in that scenario, that was the route I took. But I also wanted to say, I want to say it was in the Critical Thinking Discord, Franz comment on this write-up. Somebody had posted it, I want to say, in the Cool Research channel, and that he had known about it. Like he had said like, that weird thing with the you know, on Zoom with the, you know, reflecting the script value into the, you know, into the HTML attribute. So I think that's really interesting because it shows that he at least was looking at that sort of thing, which, so, I mean, that's another good positive indicator. If Franz is doing something, then maybe you should be doing it too.
And it also goes to show like the gadget thing is very universal where like, other hackers probably know about that thing and have probably seen that behavior, especially if you're really familiar with the program. I think that's one big thing I see a lot when people, I see this all the time at live hacking events when hackers come together after hacking on the same target for 2 weeks. There's like a lingo almost where we're just like, oh yeah, that behavior. And like everybody just sort of knows what you're talking about because
the
they've seen it.
Oh yeah, the script nonce.
Oh yeah, yeah, that thing. Yeah, did you find a way to use that? Like, so it's really interesting to see how everybody sort of picks up some of the same identifiers, but nobody like, it's usually only like one or two people who figure out the right way to be able to leverage it, or they piece together like the correct chain to actually exploit it.
That's the crazy thing too, Joel, is like about going to these live hacking events is the amount of times that the thing that you thought was interesting actually gets exploited is like, it's like 95%.
I can't tell you how many times I've seen a show and tell where they're like, yeah, so a lot of people probably saw this thing, and everybody just like groans.
Yeah, dude, it's so crazy. But it should be really inspiring because it's like, okay, this thing that you're looking at, this thing that you're playing around with, you just haven't given it enough time probably. You know, a part of all this is knowing when to quit. You got to know when to quit, right? Like that's an essential part. Right. And you know, to know your own limitations as a hacker. But as long as you can continue to ideate and you can continue to think about what the possibilities are for some of these, you know, gadgets that are floating around, I think there's value. There's a lot of value in that.
Yeah. Like if you think about it, right? Like there's only so much depth you can get out of certain things. Like if you find this CSP injection, you can mess with it to your heart's content. But I would almost guarantee that you're never going to turn that by itself into a bug, and you could spend a week straight poking different values into there and it's going to give you the same output. You have to have something, you have to find something else that allows you to actually leverage that to use it. So like knowing about it is one thing, but like just like with any bug, not everything that you find can be directly turned into a bug. Sometimes you have to leverage other things along with it to actually make it into something.
I remember a scenario where I was hacking with my mentee Mokso. He's come on the pod before. I think he was in the Bug Bounty Mentorship episode. And we were hacking together and he found this like absolutely sick client-side patch traversal flow that used like a post message and the implicit auth between a relationship between like a window generated via client-side patch. I mean, it was an awesome bug. But he couldn't exploit it because he didn't have an open redirect. And I was like, okay, you know, I'll poke around, see if I can find an open redirect. And so I started poking around and like 15 minutes later, I was like, I got an open redirect. And he's like, you what? You freaking what? You got an open redirect? And then he just like jumps up and we like start screaming and like, you know, and he puts it into the chain.
I know the target you're talking about too, because I had asked you, like we had a very, very almost bug on the same target. And I was like, hey, you have an open redirect? And you're like, no, actually, it's not the right kind of open redirect. Yeah. It's like HTTP or it needed to be HTTPS or something like that. Yeah.
Yes, you clearly know the target. But in the scenario, it ended up working, and it was like, sometimes you just gotta go hunt for those gadgets along the way. And I think as you get your, that's another skill in and of itself is this sort of, can I fill the requirement of this vulnerability by finding a very specific niche functionality, you know? And I think that takes reps just like everything else does in hacking. You gotta get your reps trying to find this gadget, you know, and get the hints on, if I'm looking at for an open redirect, I should look at the login functionality. I should look at the account linking functionality. Yeah. I should look, you know, all of these areas where redirects commonly occur.
Yeah, for sure. I think it's definitely a different skill set to be able to think sort of cross functionality within the application like that. And probably the hardest part of being like a really getting to that next level of top hacker is being able to go from just like single sort of level vulnerabilities where it's like, here's an IDOR, here's, you know, what, and then combining functionalities to piece together a vulnerability and having these multiple different things across the application that you can click together and say, oh yeah, there's this thing that I can leverage to, you know, set the cookie here, which will then force it to redirect to here, which will then take me to Google, which, you know, and being able to piece those things together in a successful way instead of just having them as separate ideas or just not even, you know, having those notes. I think that's the real hard part.
It's a force of will thing too. It's like, all right, I'm gonna bend this application to my will. Yeah. You know, I'm gonna make it happen, and I think that's a really valuable part. So we've talked about this write up tangentially for like 15 minutes now. I do want to add one more thing before we move along, which is I think there is another like one cookie tossing. If you don't know what it is, you need to figure it out because it's super helpful. TLDR is you can use a subdomain to set cookies for the top level domain. And that cookie gets sent to all the different domains. And you can specify a more specific path so that your cookie gets prioritized when it's sent in. Extremely, extremely valuable tool in the hacker's toolkit. So research that if you're not a master of it already. The other tip was, I really like, and I've seen this before, but it hadn't really like fully seeped into my brain yet. I think I could have figured it out in the scenario if I needed it, but I just figured I'd shout it out here again, is like this whole concept of switching the response type in an OAuth flow to code underscore ID token. I mean, code comma ID underscore token, right? And what that does is because the token can't be sent in the query parameters like the code can, it will put the code and the ID token in the hash. And the beauty of that is that you don't have to even like have an endpoint that requires you to, or, you know, allows you to like hand it a token or anything like that. You can just take the hash back out and put it in the query parameter when you're finishing your exploit, if you're able to leak that hash. And I just think that's pretty nice, because it's like, you don't have to find any sort of alternative flow or alternative gadgets or anything. You just smuggle the piece of information you need in a different medium, because of the caveat of also sending the ID token along with it. I thought that was really
good. Yeah, for sure. It's interesting that it behaves that way. It's very similar format to the like the scope parameter that you would also send, which, you know, comma delimited, comma separated.
There's a comma delimiter.
Comma separated values of, you know, ID, profile, email, etc. Same type of format here. There's a couple of things that we talked about today that I would be really interested to see sort of like a broad analysis of how these features work across different implementations. So different OAuth libraries that are being used to implement OpenID, as well as like the cookie thing, for example, like different web frameworks that are being
browsers,
used,
different web frameworks,
and just see like, how does Express handle this? How does PHP handle this? How does Go handle this? Like all sorts of things. I'd be really interested if somebody from the community wants to dig me
up
on that.
Give us free research.
I tell you what, if you make a blog post about it, we'll probably shout it out. So
yeah, well, absolutely will, for sure. Absolutely. And I think the cookie thing has got me thinking, man. So I don't know. I might take the dive and do some of that research myself, because we'll cover it later. Let me just wait on it. Okay. Next one on the list. Amazing write-up that I'm not even going to attempt to consolidate into the audio medium. This is the SharePoint XXE write-up by Chuddy PB. It was posted by the Zero Day Initiative. And essentially, this is an XSE on SharePoint. And you really need to go read the whole write-up, because he does an awesome job of explaining the whole flow of the exploit and how he identified it, what all the turning points were, what, you know, nested code he was reading, and how deep he went. But I did want to shout out one thing here, which was a takeaway for me, which is he was looking at a piece of the SharePoint functionality where XML was parsed. So, of course, every hacker... XXE. But there's very clearly XML reader settings dot DTD processing is set to prohibit, and it uses like safe XML safe resolver or something like that, right? And it's like, okay, this probably is invulnerable to XXE. But he still tries a couple things against it. And I'll just read one little snippet from the blog post now. I decided to play around and send a general entity-based payload as some of the text code I wrote, similar to the code shown above. So he sends in this general XXE payload. As expected, no HTTP request was performed, and a DTD processing exception was thrown. But what about this payload? And he provides another payload. And I'm going to try to attempt to describe this now. So typically with you know, doc types and entities, you've got your sort of doc type section, you define an entity, and then that entity is then used in the XML body, right? So,
So that its value is evaluated and put into,
Into the XML body, right, yes. Exactly.
It has a value within an element.
Yeah, so you'll see like a XML tag, and then you'll see ampersand, the name of the entity, and then a semicolon, and that entity will be expanded when the XML document is processed. However, that was the one that didn't work, right? However, what he does in this scenario is he actually does the doc type definition, defines the entity, and then references the entity inside of the doc type on the next line. So you've got the entity line defining this SP variable is the one that he chose in this specific scenario. And then directly below that, before closing the doc type, he just writes percent sign SP semicolon to reference that entity. And wow, this is an interesting one because it bypasses all of these DTD processing settings, and I think the reason for that is it processes the entities that are there, and then checks after it processes that whether the XML body contains any of the like entities that need to be expanded, and if it is, it says no. And I just thought, wow, there's probably a lot of sort of sketchy blocking of XML entities out there.
Considering this one on the list of broad scale research.
Exactly. Like, you know, this is you know, a pretty core .NET. I want to say this was .NET functionality here. They were talking about how these XML reader libraries are used pretty globally across that language's ecosystem. And this still had this massive hole in it. So when you're testing for XXE, it might be helpful to have several variants of processing in place that have outbound calls as well, because there could be a sort of a niche exception to that here. So
yeah.
Anyway, so sorry for super long-winded explanation, Joel.
No, I honestly like, if it doesn't click, just open the write-up on ZDI, and there's two little XML snippets, and it'll say, I decided to play around with this one and it didn't work. And then I tried this payload, and just look at the two of them. And it's a very, very subtle thing. But if you know anything about XXEs, it's one of those things that like you might try the first payload and just be like, all right, XXE is not possible here. They're blocking it, and never try the other one. And it kind of just goes to show that you know, testing in depth. This is one of those moments where make sure that you've tested sort of a bunch of different payloads and a different bunch of different options before you decide to move on, not just one.
Yeah, I totally agree. And actually, when you said, you know, look at the two XML blobs, I was like, all right, Joel, I'll look at the two XML blobs. And I actually realized something that I sort of missed before, which was the second blob there that contains the payload that actually worked. There's a percent sign right after the entity tag before the name of the variable. And I think that, so I just quickly Googled it. I think that is called a parameter entity, which the percent sign tells the XML processor to look up the entity name in the DTD's list of parameter entities, insert the value of the entity into the DTD in the place of the entity reference, and process the value of the entity as part of the DTD. So it's like,
so I don't think you could do and B in the doc type like that. I think you have to do it with percent because it's a parameter and it's basically referencing the entry above.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's like a way for you to dynamically create other, you know, doc type definitions in there, I think. So very cool idea. This is starting to ring some bells now. I have seen something similar to this before, so I understand why he tried that, but it is definitely concreted in my brain now as like a core XXE must check sort of thing, these sort of parameter entities.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. last one on the list before we get to today's prepared educational topic. You like that new section there? I don't know.
Yeah,
I can't put that on the fly. Is Shazzer.
Dude, and okay.
This is sick.
Like, you put this in the doc, and I was like, what the heck is this thing? I look it up. I was like trying to find out more about it because I won't lie. It's a cool tool, but there's like zero documentation about what this thing is or how it works or anything like that. And the first thing that caught my eye was there's a lot of, at the bottom of the page, it says like popular users and new users. Mm-hmm. And I was seeing all these names of people that I knew. And I was like, oh, okay. These people know what's up. So let me go check this thing out. And from what I gather, it's basically like a continuous sort of like testing fuzzing platform for little snippets of like, here's this function I want to call, or here's this, this, you know, area that I can inject into. What are the possible inputs that I can escape, or what characters can pass through this and stuff like that. And this was created by none other than Mr. Gareth Hayes over at Portswigger Research, creator of Hackverter. When I started searching this thing, I found a blog post like announcing this thing from 2012 that was like, here's this tool I created called, you know, Shazzer or whatever, shared fuzzer. And then at the bottom it says fuzzing browsers since 2012. So this is like super old tool, 12 years old, been around for ages, way ahead of the curve. And yeah, it's really, really interesting. There's a bunch of cool things on here. I think one of the coolest things is this little cheat sheet page that's underneath the vectors drop down at the top. And it basically just says, you know, it has a bunch of different examples of essentially cheat sheets that have been generated by this tool that'll say, you know, for example, you've got a character injection between the exclamation point and the greater than in an HTML comment. What can I put in there?
Wow.
And then it'll tell you, okay, the only thing you can put in there is a greater than symbol. Or, you know, you've got a multi-line string and there's a backslash and you can input a character in there. What can you put in? Right. And CR, I don't know if that's individually C and R or if that's specifically a character return. But it, you know, it has this for a lot of things like ignored characters and JSON property values. This was something that I didn't know, which was super interesting. You know, you can put like spaces at the front of a value. You can put a plus at the front of the value and it'll just ignore
things. Was crazy to me, like
like if you do like x colon as a string plus 1337 and you parse it as the JSON object, it'll just say X is 1337.
Well, it will, but the caveat to that, which they didn't put in the title of this one that I noticed when I was like, wait a second, there's no freaking way that works, is that it's a loose comparison to an integer. So
because it's a double equals.
Yeah, exactly. So it's not a strict comparison.
It's implicitly
comparison.
Converting.
Exactly. It's implicitly converting the string into an integer. But the interesting piece about that is like, wow, okay, I can put plus 1337 in a string and then have that loosely compared to an integer, and it will actually just drop the plus straight off the front, which I thought was really
cool. Yeah, that is super interesting.
So essentially what this thing allows you to do is define some templates, define some JS code that you want to use to fuzz something in the browser. And it will go ahead and run it against the latest versions of Chrome, Firefox, and Safari. And you can also note the differences. And I think that's a really, really cool piece of this is like, there's so many, if you go to the shazzer.co.uk website, there's like a ton of different, like most popular, most liked, new vectors that people have created, that sort of thing, where you can see how different browsers parse things differently. And understand the nuances between the two, because if you need an exploit, you know, if you've got an exploit and you need a specific little quirk, okay, Firefox might have that or Safari might have that. And we know from the episode when we talked about all the different browser market share stuff that Safari actually is very quirky for one, and has a very sizable amount of the market share.
Especially because mobile browser, right?
Yeah.
And WebKit is across everything, right? So it's not necessarily that it'd be a WebKit bug, but if it affects Safari, it's probably going to affect Safari on iOS, macOS, watchOS, iPadOS, right?
Yeah. Man, popping a smartwatch over there. That'd be something interesting.
I'm not gonna lie, that has been I've seen many of the watchOS vulnerabilities end up coming through stuff like WebKit.
Oh yeah.
And those shared frameworks that are on everything.
What was that like? I want to say there was like some crazy iMessage bug that came out earlier this year, and it was like, you know, it showed like a timeline of the bug, and it was like 12 different bugs chained, and then just at the end, like, you know, it would get like, you know, code execution in like a controlled environment, and then it would just pop open the browser and then just like pwn the system via some sort of browser exploit, which I thought was hilarious.
I'm trying to remember what you're talking about. I know the one you're talking about. Oh man, what was that?
We'll have to look it up after.
Yeah.
Anyway,
super cool site. Go check out Chazzer.
Very good stuff there.
Yeah, shazzer.co.uk, another Gareth Hayes awesome tool.
Hey guys, real quick, I just wanted to give a shout to the Hacker Content team. They have been absolutely killing it the past couple months, taking the content from the podcast and condensing it down into consumable social media posts, whether it be shorts or text posts or whatever. They've been rocking it. So I just wanted to give them a shout out and let you know that they do all sorts of cybersecurity content as well as social media management. They do technical blogs. They do comprehensive social media management. So if your organization could benefit from any of those types of services, make sure you head over to hackercontent.com, drop them a line, and mention the podcast when you do to get your first month of cybersecurity content marketing services for free. All right, that's it. Let's get back to the pod. All right, so... let me clear the throat really quick. Let me get some coffee.
Another certified CTBB moment of 43 minutes of news.
43 minutes of news. Man, you boys can yap, can we not? We can yap.
We are yappers, yeah.
We are engaging in yapping activities. Okay. So let's go ahead and continue that. And what I kind of wanted to talk to about today was match and replace. Okay. Match and replace is, I think, severely underrated by top hackers in particular, because I think that there is a lot of like, okay, you know, if you're just getting into bug bounty, you use some match and replace, you do this and that and the other thing. But I think a lot of people stop using it, and I think that's a mistake, because there are a lot deeper layers you can go into with match and replace that allows you to very quickly and easily test an application once you already have a deeper understanding of the application, and some of these things really do require a more thorough understanding of the browser than a lot of people mention when they're like, oh, beginner, go try the, you know, match and replace thing or whatever. So I kind of wanted to talk about some of the areas where I've seen some success with this. And I also wanted to try to get your thoughts on if you ever use this in a mobile hacking environment, because I feel like there'd be some weird stuff with that, since there isn't as an actual client side of sorts. Or I guess the client side is like Java code. But let me start out with this. So one of the cool areas that I've seen with this is actually using match and replace to turn on and off feature flags and experiments and A/B testing stuff. And you very often see this. It could be an HTTP request that gets issued from the JavaScript. This is the tricky part, okay? Oftentimes it's not even in your defined scope, right? Like it'll be reaching out to like LaunchDarkly or like some of these other feature flag controlling domains. And it'll be like, hey, what feature should I turn on for user XYZ? And then it'll be like, here's a list, you know, super admin functionality enabled, false, you know? And just using a match and replace rule to turn on all of those will give you access to so much more functionality and save you so much time, because at the end of the day, we're going to find the features because we're just going to parse through the JS and we're going to understand, you know, where each of these endpoints are, and we're going to try to recreate the request. But man, how much easier would it be if you just clicked a button in the browser and it was like, oh, okay, you are a super admin, and you just get to use the interface like it's intended.
Yeah, that's one of my, honestly, one of my favorite things to do is just set a match in a place to replace false to true.
Yeah.
And like nothing even specific, just false to true.
Dude, that just wreaks freaking havoc on the application,
it
though.
It does. It does. But that's my favorite thing is, you know, it shows you so many things that generally you wouldn't see. You know, sometimes it may end up doing the opposite thing. Like, you know, maybe they have is banned false and then you set that one to true by accident. But, it helps you sort of narrow down where you want to, you know, you can narrow it down later and be more specific on, you know, which endpoints it replaces on or whatever. But just setting false to true is a great thing. I would encourage, this is a little, I'll just drop this. Go to HackerOne and set your proxy to replace false to true.
Okay, so
you're gonna see a lot of really interesting things.
Oh my gosh, Joel. Yeah, and I think that is one of my first exposures, I think, to match and replace. Was I remember very pointedly talking to none other than Mr. Mark Litchfield himself, the king of finding weird little techniques. And if you talk to him, he's very humble. You know, he'll say, like, he's very humble in some ways. But when I was talking to him, he's very very humble about, like, okay, you know, I don't actually know that much about how all this stuff works, but I found that if what he's really good at is understanding the logic of the application, the business logic, the application, and that sort of thing. And he's like, if I set false to true with a match and replace rule, then I see a bunch of extra stuff. And then I can kind of go through here and dig through all these requests and document it and that sort of thing. I was like, okay, that's weird. Why does that work that way? And then I started looking, you know, deeper into it and you see some of this stuff. And I think setting false to true is sort of the naive approach to this whole thing. And you will get some results out of this, but you will get much better results if you actually just look at the HTML page, look at the API request that's turning on feature flags, or look at, if you determine the way that the front-end application is being informed about what role you are or what features you have enabled, and then you design a custom match and replace rule to enhance that. Either you look at the JavaScript and you extract all the roles and you match and replace that into the roles array that's coming back from the API request, or you look at the request that's saying, is this feature enabled? Is this feature not enabled? Then, you know, you match and replace those to true, you'll get a lot of good results on that. And I think just to what you were saying there, Joel, about just changing false to true, I think this works a lot better when you use Kaito's conditional match and replace, which I'm just not as familiar with how to do this in Burp, but I haven't seen a way to do this in Burp where you essentially say, okay, if the request path is something like this, then replace false with true. So then it becomes much more like, much less destructive. You're not taking your JavaScript file and then just saying every time false is in a JavaScript file, turn it to true. Instead, you're saying you can define a specific path and then switch false to true.
Yeah. So in Burp, as far as I know, the only way to do it is basically like an all or nothing type of way, where on Kaito, each individual match or replace rule can have its own conditions. Mm-hmm. Burp is either apply this to in scope, and then you can define in scope how you want it, it just doesn't apply at all to anything like that. Or you can, I think you say, like, it has to be, the URL has to match a certain, like, you can do it, but again, those rules are like all or nothing.
They're segmented.
It's not like per rule.
Yeah, and so I think that's a really cool feature of Kaito, and I think they're also, I've been talking with the team because I really want them to put extra effort into the match and replace feature, and I actually wrote some things that make the match and replace stuff better, and I put that into Even Better, the Kaito extension, where you can just sort of select some text, right click, send a match and replace, and it will auto populate the name and the matching string in match and replace for you, and then you can just easily create your rule. So definitely some cool stuff there. The Kaito team has also mentioned that they will potentially at some point allow for a regex plus convert workflow. Nice. Match and replace, which would be really awesome. And I think how that would work is you define a regex that matches it, and then that match is then passed into a convert workflow, which is a Kaito construct where you can perform sort of hackverter-esque modifications to that data. So You can URL encode, you can Base64 encode, you can do whatever. And this is the best part, you can just run JavaScript.
Nice.
So then, you know, you have access to a bunch of different things. You can shell out, you can do all sorts of stuff. And I'm excited for that because I think that will add a little bit more. That will allow for you to match things that are not static and turn them all into something that is relevant. Relative to what it was. So if you have some integer that needs to increase with every match or something like that, then you can do that with the convert workflow. And I have run into a couple scenarios where I just have to manually create a shit ton of match and replace rules to get it to do what I want it to do. So I'm excited for that feature to roll out as well.
Yeah, super awesome. And I think like that's one of the really awesome things about Kaido is that it has like built-in flexibility. Right, where Burp, I think you basically, to do any of this, you'd have to install some sort of extension that allows you to do it. Yeah. Where this is sort of just native functionality that's built in, and then there are extensions, but usually those extensions are using the built-in functionality.
Yeah.
It's not, you know, behind some SDK or something like that. And even just recently, I wrote a convert workflow that just made a shell command, basically, so it could work. You know, originally it was for Burp, it was honestly doing the same thing where it's just like calling a script, and I was like, here, let me just convert this over to Kaido and just turn it
it's
into
pretty
a
fast,
workflow
right?
that calls the same script, and it works great.
It's surprisingly I think they're still working on backend plugins and stuff like that with Kaido, but there is a lot of flexibility that comes along with passive workflows and active workflows and convert workflows. With just those three constructs, you can do a lot of stuff, a lot of implementing your ideas into automation very quickly without having to build a whole plugin, which I think is pretty rad. All right, so back to the match and replace stuff. This is another sort of maybe something that isn't really often categorized with match and replace is this whole ability to save yourself some time. This is such real shit too, dude. Like, to save yourself some time on going down a wrong attack path. Because what I'll often see is like, I'll make assumptions about the application. I'll see, okay, I'm thinking of the specific scenario, so I'll just give you the specific scenario. There was an input that I could provide to a front-end page that would then get passed into a fetch request and then be reflected in the body of the response. And then that piece of data would then be put directly into window.location.href. So I'm thinking, okay, great. If I can get it to hit a JavaScript URL and it just goes straight to window.location.href, then I can get XSS. And it, you know, let me start fuzzing around with this thing. And there was some really weird stuff. And I was like, I'm pretty close. I think I can get this. So I was like, I'm going to spend some time fuzzing this, trying to like figure out what characters I can put in there to get it to accept it. And then right as I was about to go down that whole like 30-minute rabbit hole, I was like, wait a second. Let me just validate this attack strategy really quick without having to go and parse through like 25,000 lines of JavaScript and figure out whether this is going to work. So I just took the value. I just put in like an accepted value. I matched and replaced it to a JavaScript URL, and I popped it in there, and lo and behold, it was not going to work. there was some other way that it was doing it that wasn't compatible with that, and it was doing some checks along the way that were never going to be compatible with the JavaScript URL. And I could see that very quickly because I just used match and replace to quickly validate whether this attack path that I was going down was actually going to work in the end or not. So I think this is sort of like a threat model validation or like a attack vector validation method as well that can save you some time is just really quickly doing a match and replace rule, validating what you're thinking about, and then deciding whether to go down that path or not.
Yeah, because I think otherwise you'd probably have to set a bunch of breakpoints and chase down stuff in the JavaScript. And that would also work, but it would take a lot more time and energy and effort to try and find that exact thing. And sometimes your breakpoints don't trigger, and you're just like, you're going to spend 30 minutes just banging your head against the wall. And
the freaking dev console, man, you know, I love it and I use it every day, but it's like, it's much nicer to just very quickly just do a little match and replace thing because it's so quick and easy. You could validate your attack strategy in 20 seconds, you know? So it's definitely, that's definitely another sort of underrated usage of it, I think.
Yeah.
All right. So I've got three more. Let's see. Let's go with, okay. Another underrated implementation, I think, of match and replace is actually match and replacing JavaScript files, which is a little bit counterintuitive because it's like, okay, normally we're just kind of modifying data in HTML or in API requests. But essentially what I was able to do one time was I was kind of sussing out, I'll be public about this target. This was Google Bard. And I was kind of sussing out the way that they had their feature flags implemented, because Google Bard was under like mega rapid development, right? Like they were cranking out features for that thing every single day. Like it was very important to Google to get features out ASAP. And so I was like, okay, well, there's got to be some feature flag stuff surrounding this. So I was kind of sussing it out, and I found this one function that was like, is this feature enabled? And it would return like true or false, right? And I was like, okay, wait a second. So I just match and replace, like wrote a match and replace rule to just make that function always return true. So I didn't even have to do this whole thing where it was like, okay, let me match and replace enable true for like this specific one and that specific one, because they were all sort of encrypted in a weird way in true Google fashion. And so I just match and replace that one thing to true, and all of a sudden, boom, like my screen just lit up with new features, and I found like 5 or 6 bugs from it.
I had a very similar thing happen just the other day, actually, where I was looking at, again, feature flag type thing. Yeah. There was a function in the JavaScript that was being called every single time. It would pass in like this key for the feature name, and then it would return whether or not it was enabled. And so I just looked for calls of that, and instead I replaced it with true, I believe I chained it together where I did like variable equals call, and then I just did equals call equals true, and then
there you go.
Yeah
Nice. So you replaced any reference to that with a
true.
Something that evaluated to true. That's a great idea. It doesn't even call the function. It just replaces it with true. That's cool. So I think imagine replacing JavaScript, there's a couple different applications of it, I think, as well. This was just the one that I had most fresh in my brain. One of the other things that I've kind of seen with this is like, there will be a weird edge case sometimes with web-packed JavaScript where the browser's like, oh, I know what this does. And it'll like try to expand it or whatever. And then you're trying to go through and you're trying to like set breakpoints and it won't do it. And it's like some statement call that is outside of an if statement will get triggered even though the statement isn't true or something like that. And essentially what's happening is the browser is messing up the reconstruction of that minified JavaScript file, and it's showing you something that's not accurate. So there's a little button down at the bottom of the dev console that's like, see the source where this originally came from. I forget what the button actually says, but it's like you can click on it, it'll show you the location of the minified source. But then if you try to do anything to that minified source, it'll just be like, you want to see the unminified source, don't you? And then it'll like send you back to the unminified source, and you're like, argh! So what I do in that scenario is I'll set up a match and replace rule to just remove the source map and just say like, just don't do it, browser, please.
Interesting.
And then, you know, you refresh it and now you're just dealing with the minified source, which despite being very difficult to read is always the source of truth, right? Because that's the code that it's actually running. And you can make your modification there.
That's interesting. I've never had to do that, although maybe I have and just haven't done it.
Joel is sitting there like, why is this breakpoint
I'm thinking like, you know, there's definitely a lot of annoying cases where I've just like given up and like done something else to get around that. Because I'll like set something that I know should be happening and it's just not.
DevTools can be a bitch sometime, man. It really can. So
yeah,
it is what it is. All right, of course this would not be a comprehensive match and replace episode if I didn't talk about paywall bypasses in RBAC testing. I did sort of mention a little bit the fact that you should really try to dive into the JavaScript a little bit, try to look at the API calls and figure out exactly where they're making decisions about what kind of user you are. And I'll share a personal little anecdote about this the other day. I've got a mentee and he was I told him, hey, I found some bugs here with match and replace. I think there's probably some more. Here's the place. I'm busy for the next, you know, week or whatever. Try to see if you can find some bugs and you know, we'll split them because I gave you the hot lead on it and I showed you exactly how to do it. And he's like, okay, great. So he gets in there and he starts poking around and he starts setting up these match and replace rules. And I just sort of saw the role endpoint in this sort of environment. And I was like, okay, great. This is where it's happening. And I like, you know, match and replaced all the roles in there. And I saw my screen light up and a bunch of features turned on. And I was like, great. And I found some bugs and I got excited. And I was like, this is the way. Right. But I said, okay, I'm not going to tell you exactly how to do it. So you can try to figure out how to do it yourself. Go check it out. And so he found that, but he also found something that I didn't find, which was like this little, Boolean that's at like the very end of a massive blob of data inside a script tag in the HTML page that was like, is admin, you know, is moderator true false? And I'm like, oh man, if of course I had seen that, you know, that'd be great. And it wasn't like is admin, it was actually is moderator. So it didn't really, I didn't, you know, when I searched for admin, it didn't like pop up or anything. Mm-hmm. But turning that on gave him access to a whole nother set of functionality in the web app just from that one Boolean rather than having to do the whole complex like role thing. So he got access to a bunch of stuff that I didn't get access to. And then I was kind of poking in there around there with him and we found like a client-side path traversal piece that was in there that would only affect the moderators. And so there's definitely some value in really being thorough about your assessment. And even if you found where you think the application is doing those RBAC decisions or those role decisions, taking it another layer deeper, really being thorough with that and trying to undercover or uncover every single little auth decision or decision on what should be displayed in the application.
Yeah, for sure. Again, this is one of the instances where it just keep it simple, you know, keep it simple is when you know how to use so many tools, it's easy to want to use those tools to fill very specific use cases. But a lot of times it's just more complicated than it needs to be. And you know, you'll write some really complicated regex or something, or you'll go and you'll set all these breakpoints, and really you should just be doing a match and replace for just a single string and just keep it simple so you can keep your testing moving instead of getting sidetracked and pulled away into this sort of rabbit hole of like doing it correctly or doing it very precisely and accurately.
Yeah. And reevaluating and making sure that you are, you know, hitting all of these different spots, like, because you could make the same mistake that I did going down this route of like, the roles, that's the whole RBAC, you know, and there's actually another section that you missed. So that's a good shout there. The other one that I was going to mention here is paywall bypasses, which, you know, I don't know, maybe am I the only one that calls them paywall bypasses? Because I feel like I searched this up the other day and there isn't a bunch of stuff on like reading materials. Yeah, there's not like a bunch of articles on this vuln type. So maybe it's under some other name, but I call it paywall bypasses essentially when there is some functionality that's behind a paywall. You need to be a premium subscriber to access XYZ feature. And you're able to bypass that. And these are very impactful bugs because I know that I personally paid a decent chunk of money, let's just say that, for access to a software that I use every day that makes my life super much better and I love it. But I only needed one feature that the premium for that software was going to add. And then I found out afterwards that software has a bug bounty program. And I was like, wait a second. And I started poking at it and I was actually able to access that feature without going through without paying for it. It was a paywall bypass on that. And I reported it and it got paid and it was great. And it paid for my subscription to that software for a long time. But I wouldn't have, you know, if I were a malicious user, I wouldn't have paid for that software because I had just accessed this feature. And it was a very simple, very simple exploit too that a non-technical user could have easily found.
One thing I will say is paywall bypasses often, it's very case by case. So some programs it's just an accepted risk or it's you know, it's not something that's easy to exploit at scale. And so they won't really, either they'll lower the severity significantly or it's just like not like a huge like security risk for them. But a lot of times you can use those paywall bypasses to test other features where you will find bugs. And then again, you can sort of like chain that together. Or you can leverage that to get a more impactful exploit. And access that attack surface without having to pay for it.
Yeah. We often talk about just paying the price. Well, wouldn't it be cool if you just didn't pay it and you still got access to the feature? So I think
about like paywall bypasses, kind of like, you know, WAF bypasses, right? It's more of a barrier to other things than it is like necessarily a bug by itself. It can be a bug by itself, you know, but you know, I see it more as like a barrier to other features and other functionality that you can test.
It's interesting you say that, because I have had a lot of success with paywall bypasses, man. I think I've been like, I don't know, talking about this specific bug type before, and people are like, paywall bypasses, like, yeah, sometimes they pay for those. And I'm like, what?
Like, I mean, it's not really a security bug, right?
No, it absolutely is.
I mean, there is like an access control being bypassed, but other than that, it's like it doesn't affect user data or anything like that. It's more like a business impact than it is
business logic error, or something like that.
Yeah, like it affects like the revenue side of the business more than it does like any like it's not like, you know what I mean? It's not like a standard security vulnerability.
Sort of. I think the revenue for a business is pretty important.
It depends, right?
You know, and so especially with high dollar products, you know, if it's like, you know, something that's like $5 a month or whatever, then it's, you know, they may not care. But to be honest, man, I've found paywall bypasses on like very, very nominal fee stuff on massive companies, and they still paid it. And I'm like, huh, let me just look at this bounty. Like, this bounty is like, you know, this bug would have had to have been exploited like 50 times for this bounty to actually cover the loss that they made. So, you know, there is some sort of there's some sort of nuance to it, but I also think that there is a desire from these companies to be very thorough with their security assessments, especially companies that are running bug bounty programs. And so my experience has been that if you can show impact, if you can show like a pricing matrix table that says, hey, you should not be able to configure the, you know, single sign-on for a non-enterprise organization, and you can, and it works for like a pro level organization or something like that, and there's a little X in the box for pro, and there's a little, you know, check mark in the box for business, then they're normally like,
the true crux of having documentation for your product is a bug bounty hunter reading it, right?
Like, that's the, you know, and
if you never make documentation, then they can't call you out on it.
Exactly, man. I love when I find documentation that's like, you know, it goes back to the whole Douglas Day thing where it's like, look for the nose in the application. Yeah. I love it when we come across some documentation that's like, XYZ user should absolutely not be able to do, you know, whatever. And I'm like, let me just screenshot this bad boy right here and just drop him right into the report. And I don't know. I feel like that kind of makes it bulletproof personally. So there's two takes for you guys on the paywall bypassing thing. It seems like Joel has also not had as much luck with it. I would say my paywall bypasses get accepted 95% of the time. So
yeah, I think it definitely depends on the business. That's what I've observed.
Interesting. All right, last one. I do want to hear from you about. I mean, well, let's just go there now. Is there any applications for match and replace inside of a mobile environment? I mean, obviously you've got similar sort of things where like,
yeah, I mean, I think a lot of the things that we talked about already apply here as well, especially with like JSON replies, you know, like hitting an endpoint to check if you're this role or if you have these permissions or fetching what feature flags are turned on or off. That's very, very common for mobile because like you said, it's not like a client side application in the sense that it's using HTML and the web and JavaScript to do all that. It's making individual API calls, taking those responses, parsing them, using those results to do things within the client app, like to enable a debug menu or to enable some feature or whatever. So it's almost a little more straightforward in the fact that you're generally going to be getting straight JSON or API responses that you can modify and match replace on those responses or requests, then you would have to go and dig through a JavaScript file and find the call that's enabling a feature flag. You can also do it, you know, less of a match and replace, but like with Frito, right? Where you go and you find maybe there's, you know, oftentimes there's a feature flag function within the Java. You go find that call, you just return true for every, you know, input or whatever. And it's a similar type of thing, but a little more involved than just on the API level.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah. That you just have to implement that, I guess, at the Java level, if you want to address it from a JavaScript perspective, or if you wanted to actually use match and replace in an HTTP proxy, then you would do it at the API level. Yeah. That makes sense. I had something else that I wanted to ask you about that, and it's escaping my mind right now. Oh, that's what it was. So like in these mobile applications, sometimes there is this whole piece of like client side features that I feel like is a little bit more expected than in like a browser, because the phone has actual functionality. Like for example, like, oh, we can't like take a picture and like apply a certain filter to it or something like that when you don't have the premium product or whatever, right? But all of that stuff is client side. So all of that is in the Java code, you know, if we're talking about an Android app for this application. So, and I did run across this really interesting thing the other day where I was like, oh, I'd kind of like to be able to like proxy web traffic a little bit. And if it doesn't have SERP pinning, then what you can do from what I've seen is even with a non-jailbroken phone, you can stand up a VPN on the actual device itself on a high level port or a high port number, right? Then configure your device to go through the VPN on the device and proxy some traffic through there. And this is a non-rooted thing. So I think it would be really interesting if they don't have SERP pinning to provide that as some sort of demo, which is like, we have this app, it automatically does proxying. There's no SERP pinning, so it just essentially match and replaces the role to true. And now we have access to all these client-side features just from installing this like upgrade your, you know, whatever filter app for free, you know, .apk file. And now you get access to these features. So what do you think about that sort of paywall bypass in a mobile context?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely trickier because there's going to be like system level. There's a lot of like system level protections and stuff. So, you know, a lack of SERP pinning in the app, there still might be SERP pinning on the system. You know what I mean? Like it's going to check if the certificate's valid.
Yeah, but if you install it as a VPN, it'll trust the certificate that's associated with the VPN.
Yeah. And then that, again, like that's, you know, a whole another level of the user has to install it as a VPN. Yeah. And yeah. Right. So there are definitely like layers to it, I think. And this is what makes it challenging to have like really high impact mobile bugs, is like usually there's a lot of weird caveats or like system level things that are kind of in your way. But I think it's still, you know, if you could put together a POC for it and get it to work like cleanly, you know, I think it's certainly a valid POC. Like, again, I don't think it's out of the question that an attacker would have control over some app on your phone, whether it's through compromising a developer account or compromising or, you know, getting you to install an APK that ends up being malicious or something. You know, it does happen. One thing I was talking, I just did an episode with Greg from Bug Bounty Reports.
Excited to see that.
We were talking about, you know, it might be nice to see some numbers from probably Google on what they observe as this, like the frequency rate of this stuff happening. Like, how often does somebody have a malicious third-party app on their phone? How often does a developer account get compromised? How often does a malicious app make it through the Play Store? I'm sure they don't really want to talk about those numbers because it doesn't look great for them. But I would be really interested to know from like a impact standpoint, trying to evaluate that, how you can sort of quantify how often how likely it is for a user to actually go through these scenarios, because that would make it a lot easier for hackers and programs to sort of get on the same page about the likelihood of these sort of events happening. And if it's a high likelihood, okay, then, you know, programs should probably be paying more for this or adjusting and saying, okay, this is actually kind of likely. But if it's not something that happens all the time or rarely ever happens at all, then I think it's fair to say, you know, there's a strong mitigating factor here. There is an issue, you know, to some extent that, you know, they may or may not decide to fix, but, you know, the overall impact might be a lot lower because of just the likelihood for exploit.
Yeah, Dude, that's an awesome point. I would love to see some data on that from Google. And while you were talking about that, I was just scrolling through my phone, looking at all the apps, and I'm just like, man, you know, like you install these like shitty little apps for like all these little edge cases, like, oh, I gotta like park in Idaho, you know? Now I gotta like
Yeah, you forget to uninstall it. Yeah.
And then like that app just sits there, and then they lose the government contract, and like the company goes under, and they sell their little app, you know? And it's, how easy would it be to just buy some of these apps that have millions of installs?
Well, and it happens. And one thing I was saying to Greg was like, especially with Telegram sealer lists nowadays, you have to imagine that at least one app developer's on there.
Oh yeah,
who's had their creds gotten stolen, and now you can compromise an app, and all you have to do is figure out the methods that, you know, all these malware devs are figuring out to sneak stuff through, you know, the Google Play Store integrity scanners or whatever, and you know, compromise an app. It doesn't even have to be like malware, right? It just has to do like a very specific malicious action or something. Like, say you're trying to exploit some specific bug on an app that might not look at like malware. And you know, all they have to do is compromise the developer. So I wouldn't be surprised if that's already happening to some extent, but I would be curious again to see what the actual numbers are on that, both from a program and a hacker perspective, just on like what is the likelihood of this. Cause I think right now the common sort of understanding is that these things do happen, but not that often. And it's hard to say how often it happens and how likely it is.
Yeah, absolutely, man. I know there are some people from Google listening to this podcast. So if you're at Google, reach out to your people, try to make this happen. I know Botterini, I think, is on the Android team at Google. So we should probably reach out to him because he might have some introspection into that sort of thing.
Yeah.
All right. Last thing on the match and replace, that is header replacements. And I think this is pretty niched and sometimes has some application. But the two ones that I came down, or I wrote down with, was host header modification. So essentially, like, this is pretty common in the world of people that do hacking based off of SSL certificates. So what will happen is like, you'll scan the whole internet for SSL certificate, you know, using something like certs.io or Shodan or whatever. And you'll get back this host that has an SSL certificate for like, you know, test123 at site.site.com, right? And you try to resolve test123.site.com and it doesn't resolve. Either that DNS record is on an internal DNS server that's not responding to sort of requests outside of the organization, or they just deleted the record and left the server up. And so you're like, okay, you try to visit that IP and it's like, you know, generic 404 Apache or whatever, right? Because it's got a vhost set up for that specific purpose. So you could go into your Etsy host file or whatever and like static the IP to that. Or you could just say, okay, let me do a match and replace rule in Kaido and say match host colon IP address, replace it with host colon test123.site.com. And then now you're navigating that site as if there was a DNS record that was resolving to that domain, and you're making requests, you're interfacing with the app like that.
I wanted to check and see if Kaido had it. I didn't see really when I looked really quickly right now, but this is one thing I do actually like about Burp, that there's a static routing table that you can add entries into. You can, and you could just say this host should resolve to this IP, and so you can basically, it's like a host file just within Burp, within your proxy, and you can route stuff to localhost. You can, you know, route hosts to whatever IPs that you want, and that's super helpful for doing this exact type of thing where maybe you have an IP that resolves to or you have a host that resolves to an internal IP or to a dead IP, or that doesn't resolve and you need it to resolve to an IP. And you can configure those on a case-by-case basis without having to go and edit your host file or do a match and replace like that.
Wow, that's super awesome. This is a great thing about Burp. And you know, you guys know I'm a Kaido fanboy, but I will give credit where credit is due. Burp has, you know, I don't know, how old are they? They're pretty old, like 15 freaking years, 20 yeah, freaking
at least,
years
at least.
Of features that they've integrated into Burp. And it's just a lot of really niche stuff that is super helpful for mega niche situations. So I think it definitely pays to still know how to use Burp and
it's almost 20 years old. Wow.
Is it 20 years old?
Wow. In June of 2000, Oh, it's over 20 years old. Holy cow. June of 2003, Burp Suite 1.0 launched.
Wow. So. Yeah, look at this. Okay, so if you go to proxy settings, you go to the network tab under the settings and you look for connections, there's this host name resolution overrides table. Yep. That you can provide host name overrides, which is your own little Etsy hosts in the in the inside Burp. That's really awesome. That's a great feature. I like that because it applies it just for that specific project too. And you don't get your Etsy host file all clogged up. And I'm always concerned whenever I modify my Etsy host file. I'm like, man, I'm going to leave this in here. I'm never going to go back.
Just like the apps, man.
And like,
you set it once and forget it. And then, 6 months from now, you're going to be like, what the heck is going on with my computer?
Exactly. Or like, I'm going to go to, you know, that host is going to like come alive again. And I'm going to have it redirect into this old IP or something like that. And it's going to be like, you know, no response from the server. And then freaking, you know, somebody in the live hack event is going to be like, well, I went to test 123.site and this whole website web app popped up and then I popped 15 scripts.
And you go and you're like, what the heck? I swear I looked at that. You open it on your local. It doesn't work. And that's when you find out that it was
the Etsy host, man. It's like, that sort of thing happens, man. It happens. So, yeah. All right, cool. Well, that's a wrap, I think. There was one other header, Joel. What's the other header?
Yeah, exported for. This is one that, oh man, so often there are web proxies that either incorrectly filter this out or completely allow it to go through. Mm-hmm. And especially if it's passing headers through to internal requests and stuff, maybe it's doing like a secondary context type thing where it's making a separate request and it's taking your IP address. A lot of times if there's a web proxy and some complicated stack, it's going to merge all those entries together. I've seen this before. We saw this very recently, actually, where it was basically building an exported for header internally and it was combining the IP addresses into one, but it was taking the exported for from the request and it was using it as the first IP in the chain. And case sensitive. Oh my goodness. This is like this one will come bite you all the time because we found this one recently where exported for capital X, capital F, capital F blocked. Doesn't work. Exported for with any of those three changed to a lowercase. Just one little character off? No, totally. Totally fine. Works. IP allowed. so yeah, that's a really weird one. And a lot of the time you'll find that your fuzzing tools like Fuff. Mm-hmm. This was an annoying one. Fuff auto capital. It like does title case on headers. So if you give it all lowercase X forwarded for, it will change the X to capital X forwarded capital F for capital F. And you'll get, you know, IP blocked unless you test it manually. I was testing it manually through Kaido and I found, oh yeah, sweet, this works. I go to try and fuzz it, can't get it to fuzz because Fuff keeps auto title casing and I can't force it to do, like, even with a raw request it wouldn't go through. So that's just something to keep in mind. You know, if you're doing a lot of like at scale scanning and stuff and you're hitting some IP blocks or anything, test it out locally first, test different cases on the exported for, test different spacing on the exported for, try like empty commas or just dummy IPs. You know, it's a lot of different things you can do. Sometimes you can escape out of that value. Sometimes you can inject a new header, depends on how it's being used. So yeah, exported for is always a great way to try and get around some of those IP restrictions.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the scenario that we were looking at before, it gave us some nice, like super great verbose error message. It was like, you're not allowed to, like, IP whatever is not allowed to access this. And we're like, okay.
Yeah, okay. Very interesting.
What if I wasn't me, though?
Yeah.
and then it was like, sure. So, no, that's great. But also, I think this is a pretty easy thing to fuzz for, too. You know, if you're just trying to find stuff that's weird at scale, you know, checking for X forwarded for with various values and then checking for X forwarded for with various casing was not something that I've tried before. So I think that's a great call out, Joel. Oh yeah. And then the actual application for this with match and replace is like, once you find this sort of weird caveat is that you can just add the header in via match and replace, just match a blank line on the header and it will just throw the header in. And then you can navigate that application as if you know that header was always there from the reverse proxy or whatever.
Yep.
So
yeah, Yeah, so match replace, it does have a lot more use than just adding your username or that required header that's in the scope page. That's the first step. I like that. That's sort of the entry point for a lot of people to find this feature, but I would encourage everybody to sort of dig deeper and try and maximize the value that you can get out of it, because there's a lot of stuff that you can do with it.
Dude, I was actually, so I was planning on ending the episode here, and I know you got to run here in a second, but I also realized that this is also a pretty decent way that you can use match and replace is for storing payloads as well. So let's say you've got this you've got this sort of XSS payload or whatever, right? And instead of typing it out every time, you just kind of put like XSS payload or whatever into the thing and have it match and replace to something. Now, I will caveat this with the fact that it is not context aware. So if you say XSS payload and your XSS payload
returns it in a response.
No. In the request. So you have to set request. You have to set it to the request body or whatever. But if you put it, you know, let's just say you put XSS payload into like a form and you press submit, and then you have a match in place role to convert XSS payload to your whatever XSS payload it is. If it's sending a JSON request out and your XSS payload contains a double quote, then it's just going to screw the whole JSON and break everything. So it's not like the best technique for this. You know, you have to be aware of how the app is actually using this, but I actually have seen it in scenarios where like you're wanting to put a blind XSS payload in your user agent, or like there's a specific set of like headers and stuff like that that you want to inject this stuff into, or maybe there's a specific niche payload that you would have to type a lot using a different character set on your keyboard. Wow, very specific example there. And you have to switch back and forth and your fingers hate it. then you can just write the match and replace rule and just have it auto insert it. So that's another use case that I didn't have down in the notes that I just sort of popped into my brain.
Yeah, maybe in the future with the more complex use cases for match and replace, like if Kaido decides to go a step further than just the conditional matches, but also like having the workflows or something like that, you could do more advanced like checking each parameter and then check the content type, and if it's JSON encoded this way, that sort of thing, and have it more bespoke.
Yeah, that absolutely should be possible with the convert workflows, because I was talking to the team as well about like, hey, you know, we definitely with convert workflows and with these other types of workflows too, but specifically with convert workflows, we need some way to access the core request that it came through, even if that isn't the input that's being passed in, so we can get context surrounding our you know, conversion that needs to happen. Is this conversion happening in a, you know, XWW form URL encoded environment? Is it happening in a put request? In a, you know, what's going on?
Is it a parameter or is it a body, you know?
Yeah. Exactly. So I think that will also be something we'll see implemented in the future, which I think will be
which
really
I've actually seen you do you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah. There's a, that one's actually public. So yeah, I have done that before.
Oh yeah. You created a convert workflow for NoAF Plus from Shubs during the NahamCon talk.
Exactly.
And it basically checks, you know, what content type is this, and it will generate the payload based on that content type, whether it should be a comment or an HTML comment or a body, you know, whatever. So yeah.
That one's out there. I think that one is actually in the, let me check really quick before I say.
Oh, you might need to update it actually. I think because
I do need to update it.
Yeah, they moved over to the new plugin. The workflows are now have to be in the new plugin SDK format.
It is compatible with that. So and it is it is in the Even Better workflow library that Even Better adds. So if you add Even Better plugin to your Kaido, then it will give you a list of workflows that are just linked back to this GitHub repo that you can pull request on. And I went ahead and merged in the NoAF plus.
I do. I see workflow. It.
Yep. I've also got my color top level and iframe navigations.
It's true. I've got that one turned on as well. Yeah.
Just extremely helpful. Like that will absolutely be a core feature of Kaido soon. But in the meantime, definitely use that to keep track of where you are in your page refreshes and iframe navigations and stuff like that. So,
yep, absolutely.
All right, man, is that a wrap?
I think that's a wrap.
All right, sweet. Peace, y'all.
Peace.
And that's a wrap on this episode of Critical Thinking. Thanks so much for listening. And if you want more Critical Thinking content, head over to ctbb.show/discord. Join the Discord. There's lots of great conversations and chats going on over there. And if you want to support the show, there's the Discord subscriber tiers, which give you access to masterclasses, AMAs, hackalongs, exclusive scripts, and an exclusive chat channel with us. We'll see you there.